This is Lisa Wentz, and you're listening to The Power of Rhetoric, How Politics Change Perception. Today, I will be talking about rhetoric being used in the current presidential debates, past debates, and how great speakers, and some not-so-great speakers, have influenced us through speech to push their agendas. I want to start by defining rhetoric, as this is a word that carries different connotations. Rhetoric is the art of discourse, an art that aims to improve the capability of writers or speakers to inform, persuade, or motivate particular audiences in specific situations. Another definition is rhetoric, language designed to have a persuasive or impressive effect on its audience, but often regarded as lacking in sincerity or meaningful content. The second definition can only be true if we can admit that the speaker is being manipulative and not believe the rhetoric to be factual. Throughout history, we see cases where a political leader or leaders have repeated rhetoric so many times that though not based on facts, the rhetoric becomes fact in our minds. Take the history of the United States, for instance. What made it possible for a group of people searching for a freer, better life to enslave other human beings? Perhaps it's because they were told repeatedly that Africans were subhuman and therefore could be owned like animals. It's rather sickening to look back at it today, isn't it? And it's easy to dismiss this kind of thinking as something that happened in the past but would not happen today. Yet we know that human trafficking in 2016 is higher than it's ever been in history. Let's look a little deeper into how persuasion works from an expert. Quote, "The most brilliant propagandist technique will yield no success unless one fundamental principle is borne in mind constantly. It must confine itself to a few points and repeat them over and over." Joseph Goebbels, Minister of Propaganda, Nazi Germany, from 1933 to 1945. This formula sounds familiar, doesn't it? Take a moment and think about what we are hearing from our current presidential contenders. In January, several of the Republican hopefuls during a presidential debate compared themselves to the beloved Ronald Reagan repeatedly. The name Ronald Reagan was mentioned 52 times during one debate. Let's look at the facts. The current contenders are much more socially conservative and fundamentally religious than Reagan ever was. Hillary Clinton is far closer to being like Reagan than, let's say, Tom Cruise, Donald Trump, or Marco Rubio. So why did they say it? And why was it repeated 52 times? Because it works. Whether it's true or not, it works. Repeat the same quote over and over, and people will believe you. It will become fact. I'll repeat the quote from Goebbels. "The most brilliant propagandist technique will yield no success unless one fundamental principle is borne in mind constantly. It must confine itself to a few points and repeat them over and over." Lately, there's been much discussion on why Donald Trump is doing so well in the polls. When he first entered the race, both Republicans and Democrats were laughing as if he had no chance. The laughter began to quiet down when we realized that although he was a very unconventional speaker for a politician and almost no credentials to run for president, he has become the Republican frontrunner and is holding that position strong. Why? Well, here's what an expert had to say about his tactics for motivating a country. Quote, "Success is the important thing. Propaganda is not a matter for average minds, but rather a matter for practitioners. It is not supposed to be lovely or correct. I do not care if I give wonderful, aesthetically elegant speeches, or speak so that women cry. The point of a political speech is to persuade people of what we think is right. I speak differently in the provinces than I do in Berlin. I say different things than when I'm at the Ferris Hall. That is a matter of practice, not of theory. We do not want to be a movement of a few straw brains, but rather a movement that can conquer the broad masses. Propaganda should be popular, not intellectually pleasing. It is not the task of propaganda to discover intellectual truths. Again, that was Joseph Goebbels. It appears it's not the task of Donald Trump to discover any truths. What he has essentially done to become the Republican frontrunner is to tell his base what they already believe, and told them the country is falling apart, and that he alone can save it. Make America great again. I recently read an article in The Atlantic that asked Trump supporters to write in explaining why they have committed to vote for him. Many repeated that phrase and stated, "Trump is the only candidate who can make America great again." So you see both tactics here at work. Repeatable catchy phrase, not based on fact, and a scare tactic. When a politician wants something, they feed us fear, and then they tell us that they alone have the solution. Trump has convinced his supporters that one of the biggest, if not the biggest, issues facing America is illegal immigration. He has repeated this over and over. Here are the facts. Undocumented workers make up approximately 3% of the U.S. population. The majority of these immigrants are tax-paying field workers. The people picking our fruits and vegetables that we don't want to pick. And this is our largest problem? Really? Another favorite of his is Muslims should be banned from entering the U.S. because they are terrorists. His rhetoric has not only changed the perception of some Republicans, it's forced the other presidential contenders like Cruz, who now says he will conduct air raids over the Mexican border to keep immigrants out. To turn this into an urgent political issue, to reinforce fear of undocumented immigrants taking our jobs and our country falling apart. I said a moment ago, when a politician wants something, they feed us fear and tell us that they alone have the solution. Speaking of feeding us fear, I want to talk a little bit about what it takes to lead a nation to war. In 2003, the country was not particularly threatened by Iraq. We were indeed worried about terrorism, but we did not, at that time, link Saddam Hussein to any terrorist acts committed on U.S. soil. The majority of U.S. citizens would change their perception after Bush's 2003 State of the Union address. He announced that he had evidence that Saddam Hussein had restarted a WMD program, and that there were links between al-Qaeda and Iraq. Panic ensued. He then asked Congress for support in an invasion to take Saddam Hussein and dismantle their weapons program. Congress asked for concrete evidence, of which there was none. He repeated over and over that the link was there and the WMDs were there. Colin Powell told Congress, "We will not have a smoking gun," which is a fancy way of saying, "We have no evidence." Now think about this in terms of rhetoric. Had the president said, "I'm here to ask my fellow Americans for their support in invading a country with military force based on a hunch that they have a nuclear weapons program. The population of the city we will invade is 7 million. Half of the population is under the age of 18. Imagine if he had said that. Now, I'd like to think that most people's reaction to attacking a city with 3 million innocent children in it, with no evidence of threat, would be no. Or at least, let's take a step back and consider what we are doing. But he didn't say it this way. He only said he knew there were WMDs and was determined to invade Iraq because the safety of the United States was at risk. And conservative pundits and politicians repeated this rhetoric over and over. And more than half of the citizens of the United States decided that this was the right thing to do. Iraq was our enemy. They hated us, and they were trying to take away our freedom. These statements were repeated by citizens who, with just a little discernment and homework, may have stopped to think that perhaps these statements were not based on any facts, but only based on the Bush administration's agenda and the media sources that were backing him. I've just explained how President Bush was able to lead our country to war by repeating, Iraq has it WMDs, and Americans are in danger, even though he had no evidence. Here's a quote from another military expert on the... And we're back. Here's a quote from another military expert on the subject of war. Quote, naturally, the common people don't want war, but after all, it's the leaders of the country who determine policy. And it's always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a dictatorship or a parliament. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. This is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in every country. As you may know, that was Hermann Göring, Nazi leader from World War II. This statement was made at the Nuremberg trials when asked how it would be possible for the United States executive branch to go to war when only Congress can declare war. I'll repeat. Quote, all you have to do is tell them that they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and for exposing the country to danger. It works the same in every country. And what about the pacifists? How was it so easy to denounce them? Every time there was an article or discussion focusing on the lack of evidence to go to war, it was dismissed as liberal spin by the liberal media. I find this mind-boggling, given that talk radio is overwhelmingly dominated by conservatives, such as Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, to name a few, and TV has its share of conservatives, Bill O'Reilly and Fox News, for example. And together, almost every episode of every show during this time, they used the words liberal media. They simply got together and convinced the nation that the media had a liberal bias and that the lack of support for the president was unpatriotic and putting the country at risk, therefore shaming the pacifists. If you are listening to this and thinking, no, not me, I'm not that easily influenced, then I'd like you to stop and ask yourself, has your opinion of refugees changed in the last year? Are you convinced that Hillary Clinton is responsible for the deaths of four Americans in Benghazi, even though there is no direct evidence? Are you worried or tense about Muslims entering the country? Has your opinion of Mexicans entering the country changed? And if so, is it possible that these changes were brought on by what you heard and are hearing from the contenders from the 2016 presidential nomination? Even though you know that they are using whatever tactic they can to get ahead of each other and to get your vote. In the past few weeks, we've seen footage of veterans, African Americans, and others being violently pushed around, yelled at, and thrown out of Trump rallies for voicing their discontent and dissent with Trump's somewhat racist rhetoric. Instead of calling the crowd or asking for a more ethical treatment of these protesters, Trump is seen participating in an angry mob mentality, encouraging his supporters to punch intruders, knock them out, and even offering to pay for legal fees. None of his supporters, pundits or civilians, seem to be bothered by the fact that he is encouraging voters to break the law. Last time I checked, freedom of speech was still legal. Assault and battery is not. So how does he get away with this? Perhaps Lyndon Johnson once was onto something, in 1960 when he said, if you can convince the lowest white man that he is better than the greatest colored man, he won't notice that you are picking his pocket. He will empty them for you. Let me repeat that. Lyndon Johnson in 1960 said, "If you can convince the lowest white man that he is better than the greatest colored man, he won't notice that you are picking his pocket. He will even empty them for you." I noticed that at the Trump rallies, after violent outbreaks occur, Mr. Trump compliments his supporters. Quote, "I have the most loyal supporters. You people are the most fantastic people in the world." He has repeated this over and over. And when he loses a state, like he did this weekend, he tells his audience, quote, "If we don't win, I will be so mad at you people." It's shocking that such transparent manipulation still works on large crowds of people. So, from exit polls, we know that his supporters are largely white, working-class Republicans and independents that feel betrayed by the GOP establishment. According to many Republican pundits, these voters are, quote, "They are understandably angry over what's happened to America in the last several years." When I first started hearing this, I wasn't sure how to interpret it. What has happened over the last several years? Could it be that we have had an African-American president for the last several years? And that vilifying this president at every turn has been a large part of conservative talk show and Fox News agenda? It would be unfair to say that all Trump supporters are racist, of course. However, looking at the exit polls in South Carolina recently, 20% of Trump supporters admitted that they did not agree with the Emancipation Proclamation. Whether it's the entire group or just a striking percentage, it appears that racism is at least partially responsible for fueling Trump's campaign. History has shown us that when people are angry or scared, the easiest way to manipulate them is to convince them that their problems are due to people they deem lesser, and convince them if we get rid of these people or take their power away, their problems in turn will go away. Whether it's African Americans, Muslims, liberals, whatever is the closest and most convenient. Currently, for America's collective consciousness, that is exactly what's happening. Mr. Trump is picking the pockets of his supporters' integrity, beliefs, and moral attitude. And they in turn are showing unwavering support and loyalty. I've been speaking mostly about negative rhetoric. But as I said at the top of the show, the definition of rhetoric is the art of discourse, an art that aims to improve the capability of writers or speakers to inform, persuade, or motivate particular audiences in specific situations. To inform, persuade, or motivate your listeners is not in itself a bad thing, and not all politicians use rhetoric to manipulate. In 1992, First Lady Hillary Clinton used the power of rhetoric to attempt to change the way that we see women's rights in her famous speech, "Women's Rights Are Human Rights." I will mimic her cadence and word stress in this short section of her speech. It is a difficult section, so I'm only going to repeat a few of the lines. "It is a violation of human rights when babies are denied food, or drowned, or suffocated, or their spines broken simply because they are born girls. It is a violation of human rights when women and girls are sold into the slavery of prostitution for human greed. And these kinds of reasons that are used to justify this practice should no longer be tolerated. It is a violation of human rights when individual women are raped in their own communities and when thousands of women are subjected to rape as a prize or tactic of war. If there is one message that echoes forth from this conference, let it be that human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights, once and for all." A powerful use of language and delivery indeed. We are almost at the end of our show, and I'd like to end with another example of positive rhetoric. This next example is from the 1940 film The Great Dictator, written by Charlie Chaplin. In this film, Chaplin plays a version of Hitler, only at the end of the film, the dictator changes his mind and addresses the audience with a monologue that starts like this. "I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone, if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there is room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost." Again, that was from the film The Great Dictator, 1940. I'll finish today by asking those of you tuning in to consider that although we are inundated with some very negative political rhetoric this year, that we ultimately choose. We can choose kindness over cleverness. We can choose to help one another. Let us seek changes with deep consideration of how these changes affect others. Changes for the good of all, not just for ourselves or those we deem similar to us. This has been Lisa Wentz, The Power of Rhetoric, How Politics Change Perception. Please stay tuned for Oh Grow Up with DJ Flying Japan.